My name is Mark Byatt, and welcome to the monthly summary of the IASB board meeting. I'm joined today by Steve Cooper. Steve is board member of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, who is director of technical activities. We're going to provide a summary of the board meeting held between the 18th and the 22nd of October 2010. Alan, perhaps we could start with you if we're able to provide an overview of the main topics discussed. I believe one of the first ones was effective dates and transition.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It was the first thing we opened the meeting with. And on Tuesday, we actually published a document seeking some feedback on effective dates and transition for IFRSs. When we produced each of the exposure drafts for projects like leases and insurance and revenue recognition, we left the effective date blank. We did have transitional provisions about whether we have prospective, which means we start from the date it becomes an effective or new standard, versus retrospective, which means you basically go back and adjust to your comparatives as if you've actually had the new accounting for perhaps 2 years, for example. But we did that in isolation, in a sense. We worked out what we thought the best transitional provisions were. We left the effective date blank, and the idea was always going to be that we're having four major projects out there, all at the same time being considered, that we needed to think about how we would manage that as a package, so as a portfolio of projects. So what we're doing is we're asking people to have a look at the transitional provisions, whether there's some way we can make it simpler or easier. There's generally a trade-off for us in that often when we go and ask people to restate their comparatives, we're trying to give the users a nice time series of numbers. But on the other hand, that's expensive for preparers and requires them to get up to speed with the new requirements quite quickly. And we're going to see whether there, in fact, there is some sort of traction for a trade-off there to perhaps have prospective, or whether, in fact, we should stick with what we've got in terms of transition. And the other thing, too, is effective dates. How long is it going to take them to actually get ready for this? This is the preparers, in terms of what their system changes might be. We're asking which ones are going to require more work, for example, than other projects. And similarly, for the sake of users, because they might get slightly different information. So they've got to understand what the information is that they're getting now compared to the old information set. So I guess the extreme is that, you know, we could say, let's just make this at what we call a big bang, and that they all come in at the same time, whether it be that 2014 or 15 or even 13, or else do we stagger them in some way? So we're actually asking people to look at this really as a big portfolio of requirements. Now, that was published on Tuesday. It's a fairly small document because it just outlines most of the issues I've described here. We're asking for feedback by 31st of January, and once we've got that back, we'll have a look at that and we'll feed that back into the individual programs. Steve, I think we're looking at IFRS 9, aren't we, for not necessarily reconsidering the dates, but we set an effective date of 1st of January 2013, but that's going to be part of this review.
Yeah, we said that we would review that as and when completing the other aspects of the project and also the interaction with insurance.
Okay. And so you can comment on that via the website, the open for comment section.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, great. Steve, I think we talked about hedge accounting during the board meeting as well.
Well, we had a long session, more than one session, on hedge accounting during this month's board meeting. In fact, we've got eight different issues that we covered, and these were the interaction of hedge accounting with the own use exception, designating LIBOR components in a sub-LIBOR, interest-bearing financial assets and liabilities. We also discussed hedge accounting disclosures, hedges of credit risk using credit derivatives, discontinuation of hedge accounting, rebalancing, interaction between rebalancing and discontinuation, and then finally revisiting the eligibility of net positions as hedged items. So it's quite a long session dealing with a number of different aspects of hedge accounting. We've got a little way to go yet. We've got another meeting coming up in a couple of weeks' time. In fact, sorry, next week, dealing with further aspects of hedge accounting. And all of this is working towards putting out an exposure draft in a month or so's time. So rather than go through all those different aspects in this, I thought I'd just highlight one particular issue that we discussed that has presented a lot of problems in the past for preparers and users. And that's the one I mentioned of hedges of credit risk using credit derivatives. Credit default swaps and other credit derivatives are commonly used to hedge credit risk either of individual loans or of loan commitments, perhaps more commonly loan commitments. And under the current rules in IAS 39, it's always been quite difficult to achieve hedge accounting. It's operationally difficult to isolate and measure the credit risk component of a financial item in a way that then meets the hedge accounting requirements. The fair value option has always been a possibility, but there are restrictions on the use of that, and it didn't really achieve an offset in the way in which companies manage this risk. So there was always this disconnect between risk management and the ability to achieve hedge accounting in this area. This created some artificial volatility in the income statement of many banks, and it led to non-GAAP measures and confusion. And I know this is an issue that many investors have complained about in the past, that the accounting doesn't really match the underlying economics. So it's an issue that we're tackling to try and resolve these things. We didn't actually resolve it entirely. We had a good discussion about it. We discussed the possibility of using an elective fair value accounting approach for part of the nominal amount of loans and loan commitments, but this would have meant quite a significant departure from the approach we have for the fair value option. Many felt it was overly complex, and it could itself produce problems. So we've instructed the staff to go back and look at other approaches that we might adopt. There are a number of possibilities. Within the existing hedge accounting framework, there's an approach that's used under US GAAP that there might be a possibility as well. So we're hopeful that we can find a way around this particular problem. I think it would certainly please a lot of people if we could find a way of achieving this within our new hedge accounting framework.
Alan, I think there was a discussion about offsetting as well. Perhaps you could just give a quick overview of what offsetting is and the discussions during the board.
Sure. I think, as you recall, we added this in June as an additional component of our financial instruments project, because it's one of the biggest differences we have between US GAAP and IFRS's. And the sort of what offsetting really is perhaps, for example, Steve and I interact in terms of we have business arrangements together. And through his activities, he owes me 100 and I owe him 80. If we have an offsetting agreement, it might well be in a particular day, we settle that by him just sending me 20. And that's essentially an offset. And the question is, lots of issues in here, but the question fundamentally is that should I just report a net of 20 on my balance sheet and vice versa, same with Steve, in terms of one party owes the other. Or should one show 100 and the other one show 80? So it's about gross amounts or net amounts, and your receivable and payable. And it's there are differences obviously between us and IFRS and the US GAAP. What the staff did was identify six key factors that we thought might be helpful in determining when offsetting should be appropriate. And the other thing to think about too is that we're not just starting off with the US model or the IFRS model. We're actually trying to start from basic principles to say what's the right answer here, and the types of things that we thought might be helpful are the existence of a right of offset, and that can be split into those that are conditional or unconditional. In terms of a sense of that, you can think about sometimes you've got intermediate parties, for example, or third parties where they're sort of a settling house for you, so they actually do the arrangements and then they make sure that they get the net amount off one party or the other. We discussed a little bit whether or not that right of offset or the actual mechanisms happen on a day-to-day basis or whether they really only happen on default. And so you start to distinguish them between, is it a matter of, that example with 80, with 180, so there's a net 20. Is it just one check, for argument's sake, written for 20, or one transfer down an electronic wire for 20? Or is 100 going one way, 80 going the other, and then there's a settling off, so the next net 20 goes back. So there are lots of different ways that these things operate in different jurisdictions. So as well as the right of offset, we talked about the intent. Is the intent to offset? The fact that you actually have the ability to, if you never actually use that, should you get offsetting within your financial reporting? So that ties in a little bit, I think, with our financial instruments models about business intent. Timing's another issue in that we actually have the ability to offset and it's within the same day. And, you know, in the morning I send the funds through, and in the afternoon you're going to do that other part of the exchange. Well, things can go wrong in that intermediate time. So is the issue here a matter of whether or not you've got some sort of timing risk in there, where somebody's, you know, business can basically fail later in the day by a matter of hours? Is there one of the other factors is the risk of the instruments themselves? You know, should they be the same types of risks? So we talked about 1 year versus 10 year instruments, for example. And the risk and the other aspect associated with instruments is the maturity itself. So what this really comes down to, I think, is two things, and the board's got to decide which direction they want to head in, or potentially a little bit of both, is whether they're interested in this offset and answering the offsetting question about managing liquidity, or whether the real issue is about managing credit. And by that I mean, you know, if Steve and I have to exchange checks, for example, is it a matter of whether we've each got the amount of cash in it together to be able to affect the exchange, or is the concern we're talking about whether or not somebody's business fails, for example? You know, you've got a credit risk, in other words, there's default risk. So at the moment, I don't think we've got a clear direction on that, have we, Steve, in terms of what the preference is?
Well, I think we're still exploring the factors and the possibilities. I think, you know, this is a very important issue. It's clearly the banking sector this relates to. And it's all about the size of the balance sheet, essentially, because under IFRS, the amount of offsetting is limited at the moment. Under US GAAP, there is more extensive offsetting. And the impact on the derivative assets and liabilities that are reported can be quite significant, such that generally US balance sheets appear much smaller. Smaller in terms of the gross assets, gross liabilities, not smaller in terms of the shareholders' equity. It doesn't affect that, doesn't affect profitability. It's simply about the presentation of the assets and liabilities. But this issue has become more important recently because of the financial crisis. There's been much more focus on leverage ratios, the ratio of the assets, the gross assets of a bank to its capital. So if the gross assets are netted down to a certain extent, then the leverage appears smaller, even though the underlying economics are exactly the same. So we recognise that we've got the gap difference at the moment. Many people are asking us to align the two systems. And that's why we thought what we do is try and explore it from first principles and look at the issues rather than try and decide which approach is better. There are many different approaches that one could adopt here. We're trying to look at it from first principles with a view to coming up with an appropriate answer to the question of the extent of offsetting.
And that would be part of an exposure draft?
That would be a joint exposure draft.
It's due out this quarter as well, because we want to wrap this up and complete this as part of the FI project to completely replace IAS 39.
Right. All right. So staying with financial instruments, I believe that impairment was discussed as well, Steve.
Thanks, Mark. We had two sessions on impairment. The first one was an ISB-only session where we were looking at the alternatives to the approaches that we'd put forward in the exposure draft some time ago. The exposure draft was very well received in many respects. People liked the idea of an expected loss model, liked some of the approaches that we had to presenting the information. But there were severe problems in terms of operationality, and that's why we set up the expert advisory panel to help us with this. And the approaches that we were talking about in this session have really come out of that expert advisory panel and also other feedback that we've had and the work of staff. We were discussing two approaches. The single period allocation approach, this would involve no catch-up adjustments and spreading adjustments prospectively forward, and a partial catch-up or a time proportionate approach where there would be an element of catch-up but also an element of allocation. So we discussed the advantages and disadvantages of those. We didn't take any firm decisions. We've asked the staff to go away and do more work on these, but we did tentatively favour the time proportionate approach. The single period allocation approach has particular disadvantages in terms of measuring the balance sheet amount and trying to identify exactly what the balance sheet and income statement amounts mean. So that was the session that we had individually. Then we had a joint session with the FASB. The purpose of that was for them to provide us with feedback on the responses to their exposure draft. The proposals they had in their ED were slightly different, significantly different from the ones that we had. They had a different basis on which to calculate the expected losses, although there's some similarity there. But the key difference was really the timing of the recognition. Under the FASB ED, the recognition was in the first period, so there would be more of an upfront loss, whereas under our exposure draft and the deliberations we've had since, it was more a basis of allocating the losses over the full life of the portfolio. So we had quite a robust discussion on that. It was based around a paper that the FASB had done looking at sort of wider implications and issues for them to focus on in re-deliberations. But we sort of homed in on the key differences between the two approaches. And we're going to follow that up with another session in a couple of weeks' time, where we're going to try and delve in more deeply into this. So this is part of the whole process of trying to bring us together and finding a common solution to the impairment issue.
We've got 3 days on this actually in November, I think 10th, 11th and 12th of November from about 2 p.m. our time. We'll have, I think it's either 3 or 4 hour sessions each with the FASB.
Okay, so a lot of discussion on financial instruments then. Just moving away from that, emission trading schemes, Alan, perhaps you can provide an update.
Yeah, this is an interesting project because we're doing a little bit of work, or quite a lot of work on the project, just to give you a sense of how much interest there is in this. About 3 or 4 months ago, we set up one of our email alerts for this, for anybody's interest in the project to receive information about papers as they're produced and so on, which anybody can do by just logging onto our website. And with no advertising whatsoever, we've got around about 3,500 people registered. It's actually more than we've got registered for insurance, interestingly. Not as many as RevRec, but or financial instruments, but it's a pretty significant number. So there is a lot of interest in this around the world. We kept our focus this week on cap and trade schemes, but essentially we had a look at the measurement of allowances and the associated liabilities for the actual scheme itself. And what the boards decided, agreed that we needed to have a symmetrical model for this in terms of measuring, or a consistent model for the assets and the liabilities, and they agreed that the right way to measure these things was initially at fair value and then subsequently again at fair value. Having done that, and you imagine the easiest thing to think about is a situation where you're what I would call perfectly or naturally hedged. The number of allowances you get is exactly equal to the amount you expect to emit, and I think then you get a natural offset in a sense. But then you have to move on to work out how you determine the quantity of allowances that should be returned under the liability or the allocation. The sort of thing is, what if you receive 100 allowances, but you think you're going to emit more than that, so you're going to have to return 110 towards the end of the year, which means you've got perhaps 100 you've got now and an extra 10 out of the market. Or what if you decide that, you know, it's so punitive in a sense that you're better off just shutting the factory down and maybe get to keep the allowances? Or it could be that you're going to put some sort of filters onto your smokestacks or something like that, which means by spending 30, you're going to save 40 worth of allowances, so there's a net gain on there. How do you do that? Now, there was general support for what we would call an expectations model, in terms of you identify what the entity expects to be able to do, okay, or expects their level of pollution is going to be. The difficulty then is, and this is where there's a little bit of, I think, discussion amongst the board and potential disagreement, is what's your kind of your trigger point? Is it that you have decided that you're going to shut down the factory and you make an announcement, or you're going to decide to put on the filters, or should you actually have to wait until you spend the money in the filters so that you've actually got that, you know that you're going to achieve reduced? You know, there are some simple solutions you could, if you decide to shut down a factory. We already have literature that deals with discontinued operations where you have to do things like, has to be clearly a board commitment to do it. You've got to have some sort of evidence. Now, perhaps that could be the trigger point rather than just some sort of general intent, for example. So essentially the board's asked the staff to have a look at these and come back with some more concrete examples to try and help them shape their thinking.
Okay. Well, quite a topical subject. On to another topical subject, post-employment benefits and pensions. Steve.
Well, we are again re-deliberating. This is the exposure draft we put out earlier this year. And the staff gave us a summary of the comment letters, a lot of good feedback. diverse views, as always, but some quite strong agreement with parts of the exposure draft, or diverse views on other aspects. Anyway, we have started to re-deliberate, and we've taken a number of tentative decisions during this meeting. We'll have more to look at over the next couple of months before hopefully moving to finalising a standard. And perhaps the key decisions that we took this time are the immediate recognition of all changes in the net defined benefit asset or liability. At the moment, there's a choice in IAS 19 that you can have immediate recognition of gains and losses which arise as the funder status of a pension plan changes. Alternatively, you can elect to apply the so-called corridor method, and that's where you don't recognise some of the changes. And when changes are large and you're forced to recognise the changes, you're allowed to then amortise those over a number of years. And this has created a lot of problems in the past, and it's not a particularly liked aspect of accounting. And certainly the feedback in the comment letters was quite strongly in favour of getting rid of that so-called corridor method. So this means immediate recognition. We also took a decision about recognising unvested past service costs when the related plan amendment occurs. It's also pretty widely supported. We also decided that we would confirm the disaggregation of the overall pension income or expense into a service cost, an interest component, and a remeasurement component. Now, we didn't take any decisions about exactly where those items would be recognised, but certainly the exposure draft proposed that the remeasurement component would go into other comprehensive income. As I say, we'll debate whether that's still the appropriate approach in the future, although it's fair to say the comment letters were pretty supportive of that aspect as well. Another thing that we discussed was whether the service cost component should include or exclude gains and losses arising from changes in assumptions related to that service cost. So this would be, for example, where there's a change in the longevity assumption. People live longer and there's an adjustment to the gross pension liability to reflect that. Some would argue that that's merely a catch-up in respect of the past amounts recognised as a service cost, and the normal accounting approach would be to recognise that in the profit and loss account. In this particular case, though, because it's really a component of the so-called actuarial gains and losses and it's intertwined with the other remeasurements, we decided that we would include it as part of that remeasurement component and not part of the service cost. Perhaps the most controversial issue within the exposure draft, and one where we had a wide, diverse range of views, was how to define the finance cost component. This is where we need to recognise a finance cost in relation to the gross pension liability, but also some sort of financial income related to the pension assets. And there are a number of different ways in which you can do this. The current approach in IAS 19 is to recognise an expected return on the pension assets. That creates a number of problems because of the range of values that people might use for that. It's a very subjective number. And it's also recognising income on assets where the income in reality is very volatile. It's recognising a smoothed amount of income. It's one of the sort of smoothing mechanisms that is in place in IAS 19. I mean, there are a number of arguments both for and against the use of the expected return. Anyway, in the exposure draft, we proposed quite a different methodology, and that was not to look at the gross amounts in terms of calculating the interest cost and return on assets, but rather to look at the net amount. So if the pension fund is in deficit overall, that deficit represents an amount that the reporting entity owes to the pension fund. It's like a payable, and in common with other accounting, we would recognise interest on that payable. Effectively, the payable is a present value and it accretes interest. If, on the other hand, it's in surplus, effectively it's a receivable by the company from the pension fund, so we accrete interest on that receivable measured at a present value. So it's quite a different approach, and it does ensure that we avoid some of the counterintuitive results that we get at the moment. At the moment, you can have a deficit in the pension fund and yet have a net amount of interest income in the income statement, which seems very odd. This new approach that we've tentatively decided on would then match the two. If there's a deficit, then there's an interest expense. If there's a surplus, then there's interest income. And of course, then the remainder of all of the changes in the asset and liability get rolled into that remeasurement. So there was a lot of support for this approach from the actuarial profession, the actuarial companies, the actuarial associations, very strong overall support for it from there. Pretty strong support from the accounting world as well. Less support from the preparers. Fair to say that only a minority of them really supported this approach. Quite a diverse reaction internationally. There was a lot of support in Germany, for example, quite a lot of support in France, but less so in the UK. So it sort of varies. And we had to take a decision based upon all of the feedback that we received and on the merits of the different approaches as we saw it.
Thank you for that. Alan, perhaps if you could just wrap up any other subjects that were discussed during the meeting. I believe OCI and FSP were two of them.
Sure, we finished today, actually. This morning we had a look at OCI and FSP. OCI, which is Other Comprehensive Income, is the little project we've had to consider tidying up the presentation of OCI. For the US, it's a joint project. For the US, it's a bigger issue because at the moment they allow these components of Other Comprehensive Income to be reported directly in equity. So what we're trying to do is to get at least what I call the same landscape together so you can actually see these components. Given that we're using other comprehensive income components more and more, or seem to be, as the project Steve's just talked about, pensions, the component goes through OCI, the strategic investments as part of our financial instruments, new standard IFRS 9 is through OCI, and next week we expect to finalise our financial liabilities aspects of IFRS 9, and that also includes the own credit going through OCI. So we think it's very important for people to see all these components being presented. Now, it was just initial feedback. We had an exposure draft out, comment period finished a few weeks ago, and the staff have assessed that essentially there are the very strong support for many of the changes that we're making, the tidy up. You know, we don't recycle from OCI back up into net income very many components at all, and separating those so that you've got just the non-recycled then the recycled separated, there was support for that, tidying up the tax and so on. The two controversial areas, one within the project itself, is that there wasn't overwhelming support for us to have a single statement. It was very strong views from preparers mainly to say, no, we need two. User feedback was a little bit mixed about that, depending on which users submitted to us, who said, some said it had to be one statement or should be, and others said no, two are very important. Often this relates to perceptions about how important net income is, for example. So that was the most controversial issue. The other very strong signal is that people want us to actually solve the problem once for all for what should go into OCI, because in the pensions project we added a component, as I said, in financial instruments. Why do we do that? What's our basis for adding something, and when should we recycle, when should we not recycle? FASB, all the US GAAP requirements, they do recycle. So those are the two things we're looking at. We're going to what goes into ACI, we discussed that when we discussed the financial statement presentation project more generally, but we have asked the staff to bring back more detailed analysis on the single statement issue. That's the main thing. In terms of what goes into ACI, we had a look within the FSP project. We're halfway through the sort of the outreach for that. If people recall, we have a staff draft we put up in the first week of July on our website. And we've been using that to just give some context to how the project's heading. And we decided to delay publication of exposure draft and while we did some more outreach. So we're around about halfway through that. EFRAG, the European group, is doing some European-based outreach for us over the next month with our staff joining in. There's a working group meeting being held in December, the 6th of December, I think it is, where they're going to discuss this. And what that signals to us is that I think the board needs a chance to consider all of that, get recommendations from the working group about how we proceed with this, Now, that's really going to push us into early next year, and of course that's our very busy period for dealing with our major projects. So at this stage, we have told the staff not to be bound by getting an exposure draft out in the first quarter. We're going to have to look and reconsider timetables on this as to how that, the importance it is to us to consider all of this feedback rather than just racing ahead with an exposure draft. The only other item was fair value measurement. I think we had one session on that this week, and discussing some of the disclosure requirements, and that's again on track for completion early next year.
Okay. So anything we should be looking out for in the next few weeks?
Yeah, Thursday we expect to publish our additions to IFRS 9. This is dealing with financial liabilities. The other thing is that we're moving all of the derecognition requirements from IAS 39 into IFRS 9. So those additions will be published on Thursday afternoon.
Next week we've got an extra board meeting for one day, again to talk about hedge accounting. And then the week after we have the joint board meeting with the FASB looking at impairment. That follows on from what I was saying earlier. And the re-deliberations that we're doing in that area.
Yeah, and our IFRS Interpretations Committee is meeting the end of, not next week, but the week after, and the IFRS Advisory Council is also meeting in London for a two-day meeting.
Okay, a busy couple of weeks. Well, thank you both Steve and Alan for your time. That just leaves me to give you the mandatory health warning that these personal views of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The only official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which will be available on the IASB website shortly. So thank you for your time, and goodbye.